Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect introduces John Battaglio, an injured worker, and subsequently became a paralegal as a result of his experiences with WSIB, and Ben Bishop of CFF, who you've heard here before. He works with a facilitating function for disabled people, especially with the federal government. Is that right, Ben?
That's correct.
So we're going to talk today about a particular case with the WSIB and what it shows us about the WSIB today and maybe changes that are necessary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John, who's the fella who you wanted to talk about and why are we talking about him today?
Well, Paul Gibson, I met him in 1990 at an injured workers group, and I've been involved with him since that time, actually, going through his case, and we're both learning about the WSIB and its idiosyncrasies. Paul went back to 1982 when he had an accident in the workplace that was due to toxin, paint, and cleaner mixtures and gas.
Was this one accident?
This is over a long period of time. It took about 5 years for this to develop.
Okay.
And these drain cleaners actually amounted to mustard gas he was mixing, and the toxin fumes have caused him headaches, heavy breathing, difficulty, sweats, shakes, dizziness, convulsions. His symptoms were increasing from his workplace to his personal living regarding various soap and perfume scents that would come on any time. Okay.
So we may have a special interest audience here in terms of people who work with cleaners or in close contact with cleaning agents.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is the story about how these things were treated in 1983. The board would pay for the time off work only, but they would admit no permanent damage from these cleaners or mixtures, chemical mixtures. And these mixtures caused chemical sensitivity.
Do they now recognize this damage? Just out of curiosity? Yeah,
yes, they do. Okay. But in a different way than you would expect.
Okay.
But he didn't get paid until, not even up to this date, they're still arguing about this.
Paid by WSIB in compensation.
Yes, even though there are tribunal decisions that state that this is a compensatable condition, and it's really not an organic condition. It's a psychological condition. But it's a condition that is beyond his control. It's subconscious.
So he's been conditioned by his environment.
He's been conditioned by his environment. Ultimately, before anything was ever done here to correct this, he died.
How many years?
This 82 to right now 210, so...
He died this year?
Yes, so that's, 20 years, 30 20, years.
28 years.
28 years. So, I mean, this man has struggled, and he has tried to help other workers in his way, because he just could not stand the injustice of this system at all.
Well, one of the reasons we're talking about this today, I understand from previous conversation with you, was that he left his family with a clear understanding that he wanted this to carry on.
Exactly. that's exactly what his last words were, that I want this here to go on. And in compensation, there's no time limit for a correct decision.
Oh, my God.
There has been one case where the man died and his wife took over the case, and after 52 years, they paid him entitlement.
Was he still alive?
No, he was dead.
Was his wife still alive?
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes. You see, this is an issue with WSIB, and this is one that we've seen as well, where people are literally dying, losing their homes, losing their lives, before, either financially or physically, before the decisions are actually made or are correctly assessed, right? And they go through several reassessments before they come up to any logical conclusion.
Well, and as anybody knows, if WSIB is hanging on to this money, it doubles about every 7 years for them. And it, meanwhile, it, you know, the award shrinks every year that the recipient doesn't get it.
Well, let me clarify what WSIB is, too. WSIB, unlike Ontario Disability Support, yeah, and unlike Canada Pension Plan Disability, WSIB was created, okay, in the early 1900s, out as an insurance company, as a government fund, as a government-administered insurance company.
Basically at the end of World War One, right?
Well, that's correct. So that's where it becomes into Workplace Health and Safety Insurance Board.
Okay.
Okay. So basically what you have is you have a bunch of people sitting at a table, or even one person sitting at a table as if they're an insurance adjuster, rather than being an actual medical adjudicator.
Okay.
Okay. Now, these people do not have any actual medical expertise. They're not doctors or nurses that actually make the decisions. They do have doctors and nurses that they consult with. They have doctors and nurses that are paid for by them, okay, to do specific tests and so forth. But WSIB, unlike ODSP, Ontario Disability Support, and unlike Canada Pension Plan Disability, do not have healthcare professionals on their adjudication unit.
So how did this drag on, John, to 28 years?
Well, the point is that Paul is a very stubborn person when it comes to this disability. Right. He is not going to let go, okay, because he knows this is the truth. Okay, the other problem here is that I want to mention is that the law concerning these decisions, mm-hmm, allows for almost patently unreasonable decisions to be made.
Okay.
So these decisions don't have to be correct. They just don't have to be unreasonable. And then if they are, you have to prove that. The problem with that is you have a conflict of interest between the board, because it's their word against yours. And they will always prefer whatever they decide over yours. So you have one hard time trying to convince them. Once they've started, even at the lowest adjudicator level, they will stick to that because it's a good old boys club right to the very end. And that's where they took Paul, is right to the very end of his death with this.
So because of the insurance model, unlike other adjudication systems, you're actually negotiating with the people who have the money.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Now the other thing too is that unlike ODSP and Canada Pension Plan Disability, WSIB will not, and I will repeat, will not take decisions from the federal authorities such as Canada Pension Plan Disability and apply them to automatic dispensation or automatic dispersal of funds, okay, to the injured workers. Okay.
Is this because of their prior establishment?
It's just a policy that they have created, and it goes completely contrary to their act. And
oh,
it also goes completely contrary to the reciprocity agreement between the federal and provincial governments.
Oh. So how do they get away with it?
It's simple. They just ignore it.
Exactly.
And this is how it dragged on to 28 years.
Yes, and
what was Paul doing in the meantime?
Well, after 1990, okay, he had to stop work or he would have been fired for taking too much time off.
All right.
So he did stop work, and he's been suffering with this allergy, different types of allergy, and any kind of soap or perfume smells, anything like that, and his health has just been declining. And I see this in an awful lot of injured workers' cases, okay? As soon as they stop working, everything else starts to fall apart, because that was their, what they did, their daily living, and all of a sudden their daily living's gone and the rest of their body deteriorates.
All right.
The board doesn't want to hear that at all either, but there are cases where this has been proven in some decisions. See, we're not saying that all the board decisions are wrong.
Right.
Okay. Probably about 80% are right, but it's that 20% that are just ridiculous. And the point is that he's right on the top of that. He's been turned down every time you can turn around. Paul was paid four times before, and the board acknowledged the disability. And then the company, the jail here in Hamilton, mm-hmm. they decided to fire Paul because he was taking too much time off work due to his disability.
All right.
In 1985.
Uh-huh.
Well, they fired him, and he went through arbitration and everything, came out of arbitration, and they told him not to take any more time off, or he would be fired again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because, so he was stuck, that was by 1990, he was stuck between can you stay at work and suffer, or retire.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to retire because of this, because the board was not acknowledging his disability,
mm-hmm.
okay, and never has. So this is his struggle. His all his life, he's had to rent rooms in his house and things like this,
yeah.
just to be able to survive.
Yeah.
And he, during the 85 to 90 time, he was on public assistance.
Mm.
And so it's been a great long struggle for him, and of course nobody really believes somebody has an environmental sensitivity in those days.
Okay, yeah.
And it took until 1998 in a case, a tribunal case, that a doctor from Toronto, Dr. House, an environmental specialist, figured out that this was not an organic case, this was psychological. And then the board started to pay for these things.
Isn't that funny? I mean, that makes it sound ephemeral. That makes it sound almost under his control, you know, the word psychological. But that's not the case.
No.
This is the thing that took it out of his control in the clear eyes of the commission.
Yes, because what ends up happening in a case like that is it becomes what we call a conditioning disorder. Okay, the psychological component of it is basically the guy ends up getting so conditioned, okay, to the reactions that he's having to these toxins, that he conditions himself to be sensitive to absolutely anything that could be a toxin.
Okay.
Okay, so basically his system is expecting some kind of a reaction. So what it does, it goes into overdrive and reacts to absolutely everything.
Okay,
so it's almost like Pavlov's dog.
Okay.
He has been conditioned to react.
All right.
Okay, so anything you're conditioned to do is not of your own free will.
Right.
Okay. If it's subliminal conditioning, or if it's situational conditioning, you can't be any more responsible to that than soldiers who are coming back from Afghanistan who have post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. And it took till 1990 to sort of get this ball rolling.
Just to get it rolling, but they never knew this until 1998, the psychological unconscious behavior.
Okay.
See, they were always looking at organic. Although
that's still 12 years before he died. What happened then?
All the way through this, he also had psychiatrists who were treating him and were telling the board that he did have a psychological condition related to this environmental disability.
Right.
And that was completely ignored and never was brought forward at the tribunal, but they turned it down. In the psychiatrist's notes that the tribunal did get, it said that Paul did not trust the tribunal to do a fair assessment of his impairment. So we start off like that.
That was when?
That was around 1987. So they went in to the tribunal, and lo and behold, the tribunal doesn't think that Paul is a credible person.
Yeah.
And basically throws the case out on the grounds that he closed his eyes while the employer presented his side of the case, and he would periodically break out and explode and was out of order and was told repeatedly times to be quiet. So this is what their final decision is based on.
So he was disturbed by somebody else's antagonistic take on the illness, and the board took that as evidence to discard the case.
Right.
Instead of course, using the medical evidence that was in front of them. Now, it's kind of difficult to use medical evidence if you don't have the expertise to decipher the medical evidence that you're being given.
Yeah.
Yes, that's another point. You see, the tribunal panel seems to think that it can decipher whether a person has a psychological disability or not.
Okay.
There are lay people,
right,
but they're experts at crystal ball gazing, I guess. I don't know what it is.
John, what's an expert in their field?
Oh, an expert in their field is somebody that does something about four times.
Okay, so if they've adjudicated a case four,
four times, they're expert.
And they're an expert.
Yes. And the legal system, the judges and the legislators stand behind that they are experts. So you can figure out what's going on there. But anyways, these things are completely irrational because you can be have bad behavior and also have an environmental disability.
Yeah.
A psychological disability. But yeah. But the panel seems to think that it can figure out what a psychological disability is based on the fact that they know absolutely nothing about uncontrollable psychological conditions.
Right. Where does that leave you today with what's happened?
Here's another interesting fact. The new AODA Act, mm-hmm, we were talking about in a previous session, the Accessibilities for Ontarians with Disabilities Act is supposed to override these procedures. And WSIB is listed as number 9 and number 10 on the enforcement list. Came into enforcement, okay, with regards to the AODA and all the regulations as of this year.
Okay.
Okay, and this is still going on.
And now for a break with Steve Baer, Memories of Albert Ammons.
Thank you.
You've been listening to John Battaglio and Ben Bishop of Community Functionality Facilitation talk about the WSIB, its impact on workers today, and the coming accountability of the Act under the AODA, how they bridge the gap between today and 2012, when enforcement will be inexpensive and straightforward.
So they haven't, the Workmen's Compensation Board hasn't dealt with the AODA at all?
No. So what they have now is a bunch of AODA violations.
All right.
A bunch of AODA omissions.
Right.
Okay. And they just don't care.
I see. So they're not familiar with the penalties?
They aren't familiar with the penalties because they don't think that anybody will challenge them on them.
I see. And I gather that this is about to change?
No. The Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario will not prosecute cases with the WSIB that have to do with the AODA. So without human rights prosecuting and without the AODA having its own tribunal, there is no way of dealing with these cases unless they're taken to the Canada human rights level.
Oh.
Or unless they're taken to the Supreme Court.
Oh. It sounds expensive.
It's expensive and completely unattainable for people who are
disabled.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah. Yeah, the first thing to go when you can't work is your income and your power to spend your way out of the situation that you're in. Yeah. What's going to happen with Paul's case?
With Paul's case will be taken to the Supreme Court.
Who will take it? We have no court process any longer for paying for disadvantaged people.
It doesn't need to have a court process to take it to the Supreme Court. It can be done as an application, okay, to the Supreme Court from the estate and from the individual and from us, from CFF, from our organization.
So how does that work? Let's take the most negative view. Here's a case for which the complainant is no longer alive, which there's no money to prosecute, and you apply through some process to the Supreme Court, and they pick it up and they pick up the costs?
Yes, because it's called a judicial review.
Okay.
So what they do in that case is they review the
right.
judgment.
Right.
Okay, of the review the judgment of the WSIB tribunal and then decide whether or not that is a just decision. And then go back and either A, overturn the WSIB decision or, okay, substantiate that decision.
Okay. Yeah. And you think that is what the route you're going to follow with this case?
That is the only route.
The other plus we have in our favor is that the WSIB records are all intact. They save everyone's cases. Okay,
so they really don't think anything's going to happen.
No. That's the thing. They save everything.
Okay.
So it's all verified what they did. They've admitted to everything they have done.
All right.
Okay, it's only a case of presenting these omissions and the lack of services from them that is going to get them into trouble. It's their own writings.
All right.
And not to mention, too, that Mr. Gibson kept every single scrap of paper that
yes.
he ever got from the tribunal.
It's about 6 feet high.
yeah, even though they were trying to ignore him, he's got 6 feet of paper. Well, what does this imply for other people who are having problems with WSIB in the past, in the present, and in the future? Seems a rather extreme remedy, but it seems possible.
Well, it's not over, they must think, until it is over.
All right.
And as long as they're not going to put up with it, they should be trying to find out ways to accomplish their entitlements. And Ben here and myself, we've been doing this for years and years, trying to find these ways. And the new laws from the Supreme Court under Dunsmuir has said that these decisions have to be correct and reasonable.
Okay.
They cannot be patently unreasonable.
All right.
Okay, so these cases can be opened again because
yeah.
the case never closes under the WSIB.
And also in the Singh case versus the Attorney General, of Canada, excuse me, Attorney General of Quebec, and Scalera Colgell, the Supreme Court had ruled that no decision that impeaches on somebody's civil liberties, okay, or on somebody's chartered rights, okay, is a legal decision.
What does that mean for this case?
For this case, it means that these decisions that they came up with, the fact that the city rehired, okay, the Ministry of Corrections, was in the jail, in the Hamilton jail, okay, was funded by the Ministry of Corrections, rehired this gentleman.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Fired him for his disability, then fired him for his disability and his difficulties, then rehired him again in an environment that they knew and threatened him. So he would have to go back into this environment that he knew was that they knew was toxic to him.
Right.
Okay. That's endangerment.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is willful endangerment.
Yeah.
Okay. That is a criminal charge. Okay. On top of that, you have WSIB, who is supposed to protect workers from endangerment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Doing the endangerment.
So they were so caught up in trying to figure out the disability, they totally ignored the endangerment.
Yeah.
Okay, and let this gentleman go back into that environment, which ultimately caused his death, yes, at 87, but destroyed his quality of life.
Yeah.
Okay, for over 25 years.
His rights under WSIB weren't served, so the service laws around the AODA come into effect, but he was also endangered by the lack of enforcement of these rights, and so there is a criminal aspect that applies. Is that the ministry?
That is correct. Because not only to WSIB, but also to the Ministry of Corrections, who funds and administers all of our correctional facilities across the entire province.
Well, are the AOD penalties applicable in each of these instances?
Yes, they are, because he's a disabled person.
I see. And this didn't have to start in 2005 when the AODA was implemented.
No, because it was ongoing.
Okay.
Right up to his death.
So what would the penalties be? I think we tackled those the other day.
The administrative penalties would be astronomical.
Okay.
Okay, never mind the special compensations for pain and suffering, dignity, lost wages. You're looking at a substantial settlement a substantial payout that would really, really, really...
Well, in Canada, a substantial payout is six figures. Why don't you tell the listener how this compares to that?
It would be much more than that. Yes. You're looking at seven, eight figures.
Okay.
Right? And it's all because everybody got so caught up in how do we not pay this guy? Okay, no one bothered to look at are we protecting this guy? Okay, it went right to the money. It didn't go to the situation.
Do you see, John and Ben, do you see changes to WSIB coming out of this? Because the government really can't sustain those kind of penalties, and the WSIB has shown no willingness at this point to even take them into consideration. Internal changes or external changes?
Well, I've always said that, in my view, okay, not even looking at it at that level, just at the board level, there's no way that people should be subjected to this nonsense at the compensation board. There should be a representative that is not related to the compensation board, that is an impartial party that has to do with human rights, that monitors these decisions at the board, from the lowest decision to the highest. Right. And this is the problem. You cannot leave them alone. You can't turn your back. They've got close to 100 years, well, coming up, we'll say 90 years. They've got 90 years of expertise on how to get out of everything. They know every question, okay? They know every answer. And I talked to a professor in California, Paul did actually, and he told me, he said, the professor said that if you don't confront them and go after them under the law, they can argue with you for 100 years and go around and round and round, and it'll never end. And that's exactly what's going on. So we have to get off of our butts and go to the law. And I don't mean a provincial law. I mean the federal laws that are coming from the Supreme Courts.
So for a solution to this, if we don't want to continue going to the Supreme Court with every unsatisfactory WSIV case, we're talking about a legislative change then.
You need an AODA tribunal.
Okay.
Okay, because the AODA is the key.
All right.
Okay, the AODA will enforce the WSIV Act itself.
Yeah, that's true. You told me that. It's prime.
That's right. Enforce them, okay, the WSIV Act, okay, enforce the tribunal to not to interpret policy, but to interpret the act. Okay, the problem that they're looking at is they're looking at making policies around getting policies that get around the act.
All right.
Okay, what they need to look at is policies that facilitate the act. Okay, and if they don't, then any policy, as we know under the AODA, that contravenes the act which it's supposed to be facilitating, okay, is an invalid policy.
Yeah, right. Under which law?
Under the AODA. There can be no policy that limits access.
Okay.
Okay, to services for people with disabilities.
Okay.
Can I add to this is the simplicity and clarity of the Compensation Act is easily read by an ordinary person, okay? You don't need a lawyer to read this. And what it says under impairment, okay, this was put in the Act to eliminate all of this nonsense.
Right.
Okay? And that's what the Act is. It's actually there so that you could have 2 feet of policy and it only goes down to a few paragraphs in the Act.
Okay.
And the under impairment, okay, an impairment under the Act. Notice it doesn't say what type of impairment or anything. It says any impairment.
Right.
Any impairment, psychological or organic, is entitled if it comes from a workplace environment or accident. And it's as plain as that. And we have this big jigsaw puzzle for nothing, basically. And they can argue all they want, but they always, the only thing that actually is legal is the Act. So, I mean, it's just a big conflict of interest. I think it's more or less just to create jobs for the Compensation Board. That's about it, as far as I'm concerned, because it certainly isn't a level playing field for the workers of Ontario.
Do we want to talk about what stands in the way of enforcing the AODA?
For this particular instance, it comes that because there is no actual tribunal that directly enforces this, okay, human rights is able to kind of wiggle out of dealing with them, okay, because they think that it's not. They try and throw up the jurisdictional flag. Okay. Now, under the Supreme Court decision of Bank of Montreal versus British Columbia,
right?
Okay. Basically, that was negated. This was in 2008.
All right.
Okay. The Supreme Court had ruled that the Hydro-Québec decision, which is the one they like to rely on for this jurisdictional flag, is not a blanket decision.
Right.
Okay. That unless there is an operational incompatibility between the two acts, the two governing acts, okay, and regulations, okay, then both must be considered. Okay, and the regulations must be considered.
So. But do you have to take it to the Supreme Court to throw that into action?
No, that's already been enacted.
Okay,
so basically. The flag is superfluous. They have to still take it.
Okay,
it's just that it's a fight. It's a real fight for Ontario human rights to take it. A real fight.
How do you get around that?
Again, that's where it has to go to Canada Human Rights, or would have to go to the Supreme Court.
How do you end that process where Ontario Human Rights is compelled by the Supreme Court and refuses, and you have to go back to the Supreme Court again?
No. Once the Supreme Court has ruled, the Ontario Human Rights has to respect the ruling. Okay.
So what do? You get a court order from the Supreme Court or something?
In a sense, it becomes a judicial review, and then they tell the Supreme Court that they tell the tribunal that they have to rule on it.
Okay.
Okay. Right. And then cases like that, they're usually generally positive.
You mean the outcome?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, so they're compelled to rule on it, but the outcome's nevertheless positive.
Yes.
Very good. Was there anything else that you wanted to say about this case where this man was harassed to the point where he made it quite clear he wanted this carried on after he died? I believe you told me so that no one else would have to go through it was his motivation.
It was that, and he was interested in this whole process of getting justice, and he was my best friend, it turned out. The last 5 years, we used to go for coffee every Monday night, and he was a very honest man. He actually was a minister, and he just wanted justice. It just wasn't fair, and that's the way I feel about it, too. It's just about fairness, and the last person you would ever want to buy a car from is anybody from the compensation board. That's all I got to think about it all.
Yeah, John's right, in one sense, with regards to what he said about Paul. Paul, my grandfather knew Paul very well as well. My grandfather was on the fire department, he was on the police force, and they all played baseball together.
Okay.
And that's the way it worked back then.
Yeah.
And the two of them, Paul was very much a believer in justice. Okay. And one thing about Paul is he really felt that a huge injustice has been done to him. And the one thing he never wanted to happen was this injustice to be played out again to somebody else. He didn't want anyone else to go through 25 years of hell for absolutely nothing.
So we're still carrying this ball for him, hoping to make this come true.
That's correct.
Well, thank you both for sharing this story with us, especially late at night, as always, on your own time, for the interest of the listener.
Thank you.
I really appreciate that.
This was a story that had to be told.
Yeah, when you brought it to me, I understood that.
And I will say to anyone listening that for us, for CFF, and for myself, this was a matter of principle.
Okay.
And there are people in the government who, if they're listening, they'll know what that means.
Okay, good.
And I will say that I have at least 10 more cases along the very same lines as Paul's.
Okay.
Where the decisions are all irrational. That's why this new act is going to really establish their rights the way it really should have been in the first place.
That's the AODA, right?
The AODA Act, yes.
Thanks. Thanks.
You're welcome.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the stories that we read, but abbreviations of those stories. For the stories themselves, you'll find them in the papers that we notify you of when we do the broadcast. First story, this one's for Ben, from the National Post, Wednesday, April 7th. Baby Kaylee's parents defend move to post Facebook video by Megan O'Toole. The videos are dark and intensely disturbing. A tiny infant covered in tape and tubes, chest heaving, emitting strangled cries as she gasps for breath. Yesterday, the parents of Kaylee Vitelli, who captured the city's attention last year in a controversy over organ donation, defended their decision to post these sounds and images on Facebook. It appeared to be the latest strike in their ongoing battle against the Hospital for Sick Children. Father Jason Wallace announced plans to sue the hospital, though a family spokesman later advised media to disregard his comments. The most recent affront, the parents say, was the hospital's decision to remove Kaylee's life support without consulting them. Kaylee struggled for 27 and a half hours, unable to breathe appropriately, and the video illustrates that, said Mr. Wallace, 35, noting Kaylee's condition appeared torturous. Mother Crystal Vitelli, 21, said the public needs to see what she's going through at Sick Kids. We don't want it hidden, the fact that Kaylee's suffering. Kaylee, who turned one in February, has since rallied, Mr. Wallace said, and should be released from Sick Kids in a few days. The life support was discontinued without her consent, without her consult as parents, Mr. Wallace said. He believes the hospital's decision constituted a violation of his rights as a parent, and says he has consulted a lawyer. Mr. Wallace also complained that the hospital has restricted his access to a one-hour daily visitation with his daughter over concerns about his threatening behavior. Now, this is just a news review, but I can't resist editorial comment on this one. Who's threatening whom here? And where are the Attorney General and the Premier when you need them? And from the same paper, the National Post, Wednesday, April 7th, meet Toronto's hungry humanitarians. A group of prominent Torontonians have announced they are changing their eating habits for a week to highlight the plight of welfare recipients. Do the math. An initiative by the Stop Community Food Center challenges each participant to subsist on a standard hamper of food valued at $25 to $30 for as long as possible. The stunt aims to, among other things, pressure the Ontario government to institute a monthly healthy food supplement of $100 for all adults on welfare. The Post's Natalie Alcoba explains. Michael McMillan, for example, former chairman of Alliance Atlantis, usually spends $400 to $500 a week on food, not including restaurant meals. I'm not expecting to make it through the week on this food, but I'm hoping to bring attention to this topic, Mr. McMillan said in an interview yesterday. Most of the welfare check goes to rent, and when you do the math and figure out what's left over primarily for food, it's difficult to figure out how that is remotely possible to live on in a healthy way. His friends and family smiled and wished him luck. For others, the conversation turns to, well, if you think this is difficult, what about all the other people in other parts of the world who survive on a dollar a day or less? Which is true, but it's also a different topic. In this society, there is no reason why people should be required to eke by on such minimal assistance, Mr. McMillan said. The conversation also turns to the issue of fairness and individual responsibility. And why is it all of our responsibility to help these people? Well, if we don't, we pay for it anyway through a less healthy population. Ultimately, we have to collectively figure it out. And from The Spectator in March, Meredith McLeod, Cities Can't Sustain Rise in Poverty. This is a full-page column, so we won't give you a lot of it. Hamilton is far from alone in bending under the weight of downloaded social services. A report by the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, released, says cities can't meet the growing needs of vulnerable people by themselves. The report, called Mending Canada's Frayed Social Safety Net, points out that despite a growing economy and declining unemployment rates between 2001 and 2006, the incidence of poverty in Canada's large and medium-sized cities grew. The recession only deepened the problem, with soaring unemployment rates in most every city across the country. The Federation of Canadian Municipalities says federal and provincial governments must reverse downloading and begin to reinvest in the social safety net. Cities form the social infrastructure that a growing number of people rely on to earn a living, raise their families, and cope with difficult times. For a growing number of Canadians, their city is their safety net, reads the report. Property taxes shouldn't be used to redistribute wealth because it's a regressive tax, says the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. It amounts to taxing low-income earners to support other low-income earners. To illustrate, a study in 2003 found the poorest 20% of Canadians spend a dollar of every $10 they earn on property taxes, while the richest 20% spend less than $2 of every $100 earned. In an analysis of how people in the lowest 20% of income earners can afford a market basket of goods, Hamilton lined up closely with Ottawa, London, Sudbury, and York. And from the Globe and Mail, Wednesday, April 7th, Ontario natives bear Mercury's toxic legacy. Research traces ongoing impact of Poisoned River on youth and communities living in the Grassy Narrows area. By Anna Mailer Paperny. For Rudy Turtle, the shakes started 15 years ago, his body overcome by tremors when he tried to lift wood or anything heavy. They were soon accompanied by a constant numbness in his forearms. His fingers are now curled into a permanent crooked position. He was just 5 years old in 1970 when the Ontario government told the people in Grassy Narrows to stop eating the fish from the local river. His first memory of the mercury poisoning in his community is of his parents going to get tested when he was 11. Betty Riefel, now 75, is old enough to remember seeing local dogs collapse in seizures
in the streets of tiny Quibel community. Her own tremors became uncontrollable in the early 1990s, making it impossible for her to keep her nursing job in Kenora. Ms. Riefel and Mr. Turtle say their symptoms can be traced to the mercury that environmental groups claim was poured into the Wabagoon River system by Dryden Chemicals Pulp and Paper Mill between 1962 and 1970. The chemical says a 2001 report contaminated the water for 250 kilometers, made the fish inedible, and decimated the economies of tiny native communities by the water's edge. Neither Ms. Riffle nor Mr. Turtle received compensation from a disability board set up in 1985 in response to the crisis. Research published yesterday conducted by Masazumi Harada, the well-known Japanese scientist who put mercury poisoning on the world's radar decades ago, suggests there are many patients still suffering that have not been acknowledged yet. A spokesman for Ontario's Aboriginal Affairs Minister, Chris Bentley, said the government hasn't had time to read the report yet. Scott Cavan noted the provincial and federal governments are still providing benefits for eligible people under the 1985 settlement agreement. And from The Spectator again in March, Friday, March 26th, area hospitals forced to get scalpel out. 1.5% fund increase short of expected 2%, meaning there will be some cutting to do. Area hospitals have to cut about $7 million deeper after getting less provincial funding than expected. The hospitals got a 1.5% increase in the budget instead of the 2% they'd anticipated. They'd already started cutting surgeries, beds, and staff to deal with a predicted shortfall of about $25 million locally that would have resulted from a 2% increase. Now it's unknown how they will make up the half a percentage point difference. The Ontario Nurses Association has seen more than 1,800 nursing positions cut over the past 8 months, totaling more than 3.5 million hours of patient care per year as hospitals across the province struggle to balance the books. Hospitals say their costs will rise between 3 and 5% in the fiscal year starting April 1st. They are getting 1.5% from the province and are not permitted by law to run a deficit. St. Joseph's plan to raise the price of parking to help offset its $6 million deficit on its $500 million budget. St. Joseph Brant planned to increase revenues and improve efficiencies to deal with the $1.6 million shortfall on its $142 million budget. Now all of that is up in the air as the hospitals go back to the drawing board to determine how they will cope with getting about $7 million less than they hoped. Overall health spending will be capped at 3% growth each year, according to the budget, even as the Liberals hold the growth in other program spending to an average of 1.9% beyond 2012-2013. And in The Spectator, March the 23rd, Denise Davey, local news desk, up to 9-year wait for subsidized housing in the city. For 6 years, Seema Gulabzada, her husband, and their 7 children have crowded into a small 3-bedroom apartment. At night, Seema sleeps in the living room with 2 of her daughters. Her husband shares a bedroom with some of their sons. The rent of $950 per month plus utilities eats up more than half of what her husband receives from the Ontario Disability Support Program. They applied for subsidized housing 6 years ago, but have been told they may have to wait several more years because of the shortage of units for large families. "This is a big problem for my family," said Seema, who moved here from Afghanistan 6 years ago. "At night, I am very sad. I feel depressed." Large families such as the Gulabzadas face the longest waits of any group for subsidized housing in Hamilton. That wait can be up to 9 years. That's because of the 14,415 subsidized units available, only 502 are 4-bedroom and 78 5-bedroom units. Larry Hulbers, executive director of the Housing Help Center, said the shortage affects new immigrants because they often have large families. "If we don't get better at finding housing for larger families, we're not going to be an attractive community for new families," said Hulbers. And in a sidebar, the Ministry of Housing and Municipal Affairs has increased the amount of money available to Hamiltonians facing eviction for not being able to pay their rent. The Provincial Rent Bank is providing $195,000 to Hamilton for 2010, up from $130,000 last year. Tenants can apply for a maximum of 2 months' rent. Each municipality determines client eligibility. For more information, contact the Housing Help Center at 905-526-8100. And in another editorial comment, don't expect any sympathy if your 18-year declining fixed income has left you spending more than you receive. They won't lend you a dime. Globe and Mail, Thursday, April 1st. Wrongfully prosecuted woman denied payment. For 9 years, Brenda Wadby suffered under the shadow of a wrongful prosecution for the 1997 murder of her 2-year-old daughter. Apparently, she didn't suffer enough. The Peterborough, Ontario woman has been denied up to $25,000 from Ontario's Criminal Injuries Compensation Board because she did not meet its criteria for suffering nervous shock. The board has also denied a claim from Mrs. Wadby's other daughter, Justine Trainer, who was seized and placed in a foster home for 2 years after her mother was charged with murdering Justine's sister, Jenna Miller. I cannot understand or fathom the reasoning for this decision, Ms. Wadby said yesterday. I cannot move forward until this nightmare, which is being sustained and perpetuated by the government, is over. I believe the government needs to quit dragging their heels and fix this. I'm tired of being patient. My life has not changed, she said. My life is the same. The government has implemented many recommendations, but the victims appear to have been forgotten completely. In a letter sent to Attorney General Chris Bentley, Mrs. Wadby's lawyer, Julie Kirkpatrick, asked him to intervene and reverse the board's decision. With respect, the board's decisions are shockingly dismissive of the genuine, extreme, and ongoing pain and suffering experienced by Mrs. Wadby and Ms. Trainer as a result of Jenna Miller's murder, Ms. Kirkpatrick wrote. She noted that due to autopsy mistakes made by disgraced pathologist Charles Smith, Ms. Wadby remained a prime suspect until 2006, when Jenna's former babysitter was convicted of the killing. Under board guidelines, nervous shock is assessed based on the degree of violence involved in the incident, the relationship between the applicant and the victim, the applicant's presence at the scene of the incident, and/or how the applicant learned of the occurrence, the degree of the emotional and psychological injuries suffered, and the type of treatment required. Ms. Wadby said that she continues to sustain psychological blows, including a recent revelation that portions of Jenna's remains are still being kept at the office of the chief coroner. At the conclusion of the public inquiry, recommendations were made by Justice Goodge. Mrs. Wadby added, these recommendations included looking into a viable scheme for compensation for the victims. The government has not made any announcements regarding this issue. This is shocking because almost 2 years have passed since the inquiry was completed. And before we go, two items. One is an announcement. OCAP has arranged a mass mobilization to raise the rates rally in March on the McGuinty government Thursday, April 15th, 12 noon, Allen Gardens Park in Toronto. The rally is going to go to Queen's Park and make the case for stopping the suspension of the special diet and increasing the welfare rates by 40%. The difference, says OCAP, between sickness and health. Reminding you that disability isn't so bad when you consider the alternative. Pair caught taking corpse onto flight. Quote, he always sleeps like that, by Nigel Bunyan and Carolyn Gamel. Two women allegedly placed their dead relative in a wheelchair, dressed him in sunglasses, and then tried to board a flight with him in England. However, the dead body was discovered by a shocked airport worker called to help the disabled passenger from a taxi. To my horror, his face fell sideways against mine. It was ice cold, Andrew Milia said. Going out, we have Memphis Slim, Broadway Boogie. Thank you.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.